Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Hey, it's Max. Before we get started, I have an announcement to make. It's this. The Longform Podcast is throwing a party. It's on February 13th at the Bell House. You, if you are listening to this, are invited. Tickets are free, but there is a suggested donation. The party is in honor of Evan Ratliff, my co-host's new book. It's called The Mastermind, and the suggested donation is buy a copy of Evan's book. The book, I can tell you, is incredible, and you don't have to take my word for it. I am incredibly biased, although the book really is good. Publishers Weekly just reviewed it. They called it a true crime classic. It is legitimately a great book, and we are celebrating the incredible amount of effort that Evan put into it with this party, but we're also going to do a live version of the show, and the guest I am pleased to announce is one of my favorite long-form podcast guests ever, Taffy Broadesser-Ackner of the New York Times. You have read her stuff. It has made you laugh. It has made you feel all kinds of feelings. She is going to be with us, potentially some other folks. Come out February 13th, Bell House, Brooklyn, New York, long-form podcast party. Tickets are free. See you there. Here's the show. Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey, good afternoon, Max. Did you speak to? It doesn't matter how we are.
None of that matters. I talked to Julie Snyder. Her official title is CEO of Serial Productions, but she is best known as the editor of Serial, the podcast. You guys know it. The first season changed the entire landscape of podcasting. Their third season just wrapped. It was stories from one courthouse in Cleveland, ordinary cases told week by week. Julie was also the editor of S-Town. We had Brian Reed from S-Town in the day after that show launched, but she was the co-creator of that. She is a behind-the-scenes person. She was at This American Life for 18 years before Serial. She was the senior producer for a long time, sort of managing the show, but she only did radio stories herself, like on the mic, for a couple years and decided to give that up. And behind the scenes people are rare in radio. And so we talked about that. We talked about why she decided to get off the mic. And then also we talked about, like, basically everyone I've talked to from This American Life on long form, Brian Reed, Ira Glass, Zoe Chace, at one point or another in those conversations, they've all said that Julie is kind of the genius behind the place. So we talked about how she thinks about structure and what her actual job is. She was great. We talked for a really long time. She was, you know how sometimes people just come to this thing and, like, they're just game? She was game.
If you are looking to tell people what's going on behind the scenes in your company, do it with a newsletter, MailChimp newsletter. Everyone likes email. No one likes anything but email, and that's the state of the world. Thank you to MailChimp. Max, it was very good to see you in the emergency room this week. Yeah. That was normally we try to keep it professional on this these show introductions, but I Just for the longtime fans out there who've known Max and I since our FIFA playing days, we ran into each other in the middle of the night at a pediatric ER this week.
I think you have to say everyone's fine.
Everyone's fine.
Everyone's fine. Everyone's fine. I got to tell you, looking through, it was like one of those doors with just like the thin window, you know? Yeah. And I like poked my head through to see what kind of like line situation we were looking at. And Aaron just sitting there with his daughter. And it was so surreal. And like I caught Aaron's wife's eye for a second and she stared at me for like 5 seconds and then looked away like it just couldn't be real. It was so disconcerting. And then they put us together, like beds next to each other. It was a real long form podcast moment.
I'm gonna actually bring up several other things that happened. On the way there, we were having the discussion. It's the first time we've ever taken a child to the emergency room. We were having a discussion about whether we needed to go to the emergency room or not, and I said Max takes his kid to the emergency room all the time.
Okay.
And it was true.
That is true. Also, we're just going to acknowledge this. You took your daughter to the emergency room because it was like the first time she'd ever cried.
Yeah, she was constipated. I'd also like to say that once we got, well, actually, they offered Max a room, but there was no offer for a room for me. And Max was like, it'll be fine. Come in the room. Then we were later assigned the other half of that room, which had some sort of extremely elaborate TV monitor on wheels with a video game rig. Max was playing FIFA in the hospital.
My kid was fine too.
We're gonna put out the rest of this story as a special episode. In the meantime, here's Max with Julie Snyder.
Hey, Julie.
Hello.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm happy that you're here. I feel like it's like a long time coming. We've been trying to do this for a while.
I'm really happy to do it. You did bounce me.
What? Like,
yeah, you did.
That's bullshit.
You did.
No.
In favor of Hana.
No. It wasn't a full bounce.
It was a bounce-ish.
There had been like mutual bouncing.
I didn't bounce you.
Well, you didn't. The first email in our chain of like,
I know, is me apologizing. You're right.
But also because I was trying to do like a live thing.
Okay,
you said no.
Sorry.
And I only bounced you for your colleague. But it wasn't even a bounce. I made you promise that you would do it.
Thank you. Yeah, you're right.
Anyway.
Yeah, I'm glad to be doing this. I'm really happy to be here.
No one needs to relive our apology stack email chain. But I'm glad you're here. And the one nice thing about you being here, if we had done it before, we wouldn't have had season 3 of Serial to talk about.
Now we have season 3, yeah.
Can we start there?
Oh, yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Okay.
Here are some things that I wondered listening to it. One is, how do you guys decide to do that? Like, my imagination is that you could have done almost anything for season 2 or for season 3.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very interested in how you decide to do the courthouse in Cleveland.
I mean, we had a couple of other ideas, but this was the one I felt like I had the most clear vision on, because it was one that I had thought about doing since even before season 1. I had read a book called Courtroom 302, where this Chicago reporter, he's a really great reporter in Chicago, and he did the same kind of thing. We basically just ripped it off from him. He spent a year in one courtroom in Cook County in Chicago. And
who's that?
His name's Steve Bogira. And when I read his book, I just felt like this is how it works. I mean, first of all, he scratched itches that I've always wondered, which is, one of his opening scenes is just defendants went right after they get arrested and moved from the precinct police stations and brought over to the courthouse when they're getting arraigned. And I had sort of wondered, how much information does a judge have in front of them when they're making the determination of whether or not this person gets bail, if they get released on their own recognizance, if they go back to jail, what? And he describes it. It's crazy. They have all the defendants lined up. There's a hallway that's sort of like behind the courtroom, mm-hmm. you know, so they come in through the back door and they have them all lined up in that hallway. And whoever is like closest to the door, you're on deck. And he described that basically the moment you walk from being on deck to like say, the batter's box, yeah. you know, to the middle of the room. And that takes, I think he described it as taking 7 seconds. And that's the amount of time where they determine, you know, your future for the next 6 months.
Right. Your fate's decided in 7 seconds.
Yeah. And I just was like, that is fascinating to me. This is fascinating. Nobody is weighing evidence. Nobody is thinking, does this make any sense? Are these strong charges? Like, are there two sides to this story? You know, there's nothing like that. And so I really loved that. And then he really structures the book in a whole way of where, I mean, you know, you definitely see there are just two criminal justice systems mm-hmm. at work. There is one for white Chicagoans and one for black Chicagoans. And there is so much gaslighting going on, pretending like that doesn't exist by white Chicagoans. But mainly all the people in power in the justice system are white. Mm-hmm. So they're the ones who are kind of, you know, they tell a story that it does not reflect reality at all.
So that idea had been kicking around with you for a while?
Like, yeah,
you wanted to do a series on it?
I was just like, that'd be so cool to do. I feel like this is such a good idea. It's so clean. You know, it's such mm-hmm. a clean idea of like 1 year in one courtroom. And
can you just tell me a little bit more about what you mean by clean idea?
It's just a simple concept. You know what I mean? There was nothing that complicated about explaining what he was doing. And then I also was just like, it's just one story. You know, every case is just a different story. And so mm-hmm. I was like, God, this is like a story machine, you know, and they're just like story, 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 story. So, and then it was really an imperative. I love the season one story. I love the Adnan Syed case. I did feel, I mean, I had so many feelings after that story came out, but the feeling of like kind of being like, you guys really expose the criminal justice system, I always felt weird about it. Because if anything, I felt like the story was way more about journalism than it was about the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. I thought we said a lot more about the nature of being a writer and a reporter and what it's like and what that means and what the trade-offs are and kind of like just that whole process.
Yeah.
I felt like we kind of opened that up a lot more than the actual criminal justice system. I mean, to an extent.
What were your other feelings?
About the season one story?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I had so many feelings. I mean, it was weird. It's weird to be that public. Mm-hmm. And my name was not the public name, you know, that was Sarah. And God, for her, even what she went much more into a bunker. But I think both of us just, we have egos, but we don't have big enough egos to absorb what that was. Instead, we both felt very kind of humiliated and embarrassed and did not want all that attention and couldn't handle criticism either. Like that, we were really, I mean, I am constantly second guessing myself. I am full of regret and recrimination all the time. And I don't pride myself on it because it probably goes too far. But in other ways, I do feel like I am a person who is very flawed and I make mistakes and I try and learn from them and I try and be very open to other people's thoughts and their input and everything like that. So to be that open to criticism was like rough after the first season because we just got so much attention. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, while like a lot of it was, you know, I could feel like people being like, oh, go cry on your bags of money. Like, you know what I mean? Like you guys got all, you know, it was huge. I got that. But at the same time, it's hard to ignore. And I would tell myself, I don't want to pull one of these like Taylor Swift, like haters gonna hate. You know what I mean? Like, I was just like, that's for dumb people. That's what dumb, insecure people do is convince themselves that critics are just haters.
So what do smart, secure people do?
I think like try and figure it out and sort through it and figure out like what seems fair and what doesn't and what do you want to change and like what have you learned moving forward and all that kind of stuff. But that was like kind of painful and stressful and anxiety provoking.
Yeah, I can imagine that. So I want to get back to Cleveland, but
yeah,
now I have real questions for you about this. Okay, so you said like we have egos, but they're not quite big enough for all that attention.
Yeah.
So like when your ego cup like runs over, where does that attention go? Like what do you do?
I mean, ignore it, then try and just like put a cap on it of being like, there's only so much I can read. There's only so much I can kind of take in right now. I'm kind of going to have to wait. And I think I've gotten a lot better about that now. At the time, that was a little hard because at This American Life, when we would do stories, it's weird to do radio stories because you don't get immediate feedback, you know? And so you work really hard on this thing and then you put it out on the airwaves and you're not really sure if anyone's listening and if they had any response. Then as like kind of social media started building, like you get a little bit, you know? So I know when we were producers at This American Life, you know, sometimes you put out a story that you really loved and you'd be like checking Facebook that weekend and stuff to see what people liked. When we did Serial, at first I was used to reading that stuff. Then partially I felt like it was my job to read a lot of it because I needed to be aware of what was going on. But then after a while I was just like, I can't handle this. And I deputized somebody. I was like, just let me know if there's anything that comes up that you think I should know. Otherwise I need a break.
Yeah, you can't be just sitting there like searching like a Serial on Twitter.
Yeah. No, it was hard.
Hey, I'm going to stop this conversation about podcasts with Julie. Tell you about another podcast you should check out. It's called First Day Back. It's all about people coming back from the hardest experiences of their lives. Last season was about Lucy and her life after serving a prison sentence for shooting her own husband. The story, as you can imagine, is pretty intense. Go back and listen to that one. It's incredibly well-researched. It's well-made. Got rave reviews from places like The Guardian. But they got a new season out. The host is a documentarian, Tali Abacasis, and she's telling the story of a comedian who basically died on stage. His heart stopped for 5 minutes, and Tali tells the story of that and what happens next. Go find First Day Back in your podcast app now. Give it a listen, and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss any episodes from this new season. Go check it out. Thanks very much to them for sponsoring the show. Let's get back to Julie. Were there critiques of it that has stuck with you?
Yeah. I mean, there's one of the main ones was actually, weirdly, that not a lot of people talked about, but a friend of mine talked to me about and I thought was totally fair, especially after we just did season three, which is that we did not really explore the fact that Jay, as a Black teenager, as like a Black man in Baltimore, especially at that time, to cooperate with the police was bonkers, and just the context of what he would be facing. And I had a friend of mine who's a little older than Jay, but he grew up in DC, and he was saying to me that that was like his one criticism of it. And he was like, you know, and think at that time in Baltimore, and I think that might have been right around, maybe it was a few years after, remember like the mother in Baltimore who had tried to organize like a Black association because of the drug dealing on the block, and then they firebombed her house.
Yeah.
And he was just like, you know, it was just coming off of like the years of that, like no snitching was so huge and fundamental and part of your identity that he just felt like that was like a really, like that we were blinders on that one. And I think he was totally right. So, you know, like in an editorial way, I've always just been all like, okay, yeah, we fucked that up and we should have gone there and we should have understood it. And then in the other way, sometimes like I feel like, you know, the whole question was like, is it too entertaining? Are you making it too entertaining? Are you like sort of in an exploitative way, which was like an interesting way. That was the thing that, and I honestly still kind of struggle with it because I felt really conscious when we were making the first season of, I really don't want this to feel like a Dateline story. I really don't want to feel like we're doing, you know, there are entire networks that are devoted to murder stories about like teenage white girls. Like, I really don't want to be in there. I want to be very respectful to her family. And the way kind of we did that is we didn't talk about her that much because I felt like talking about her that much would be assuming that we really knew her. And we don't. We don't know her. And to pretend like in some goopy sentimental way of like, let us really remember who the real victim is here and then goop it up. Just to me, I felt like it was such a hack, false move, a cynical hack, false move that I recognized from like other TV shows and documentaries. And I was like, no way, I can't live with myself going, and like, we're not going to do that. And so it was also like, you know, we're not going to, no pictures, none of that kind of stuff. But then still, like, we get kind of, we got a lot of criticism as if it was like entertainment. It was too entertaining, mm-hmm. or that we were exploiting it. And I think that's where it was hard for me to figure out like what to do with that, because I was like, wow, I really felt like we were trying, you know, like basically we really could have gone much further.
Yeah, you should have seen the shit that we didn't do.
Like, really? But also, I don't know how to structure a story. I don't know how to make stories that aren't compelling and have like anecdotal drama and feeling and wanting to know what happens next. Like, I don't really actually know how to do it without doing that. To me, a little bit, I'm just like, make it more boring. Is that what you're saying? But well, you know, we struggled with it on season three too, because there was a bit of a feeling when we were halfway through the season, there is an episode that Emmanuel Joachi, the co-host this season, did about this guy Jesse Nickerson. And it is like it's a nuts story. Like, Jesse gets beat up by these two cops in his suburb in East Cleveland, and but they actually get prosecuted and one of them goes to prison. And but then he's living in fear of retaliation. Emmanuel is actually with him in a moment where they do kind of have a creepy surveillance scene with one of the cops. Yeah. East Cleveland has some really insane, insane stories of and lawsuits and proven cases of things that they've done to arrestees in East Cleveland and locking them in rooms for 5 days without food or water. And so anyway, there were like kind of like events that happened in that episode. And Emmanuel was also then later with Jesse, where Jesse gets arrested, like sort of in a surprise arrest, kind of in the courthouse. And I knew, like, obviously I knew like there was a lot of drama that happened in that, like in Jesse's story, and things because of Emmanuel being with him at those moments that he was actually like capturing in the moment. And so, of course, like, you know, there's a structure to that story of being like, okay, Jesse's a two-parter story. We'll do the first part that is these scenes and like laying out his fear of the police, which is like a well-founded fear. Then I have like more of an interest because he kept on going with Jesse, and we'll do the second part of the story about Jesse's trauma. And there was a lot of this response after the first part of Jesse's story aired that we saw of from white people of like, holy shit, I didn't see it going that way. That was a crazy plot twist. Now this is the serial I wanted. That kind of response.
Because there was drama?
I guess. And I just felt, I listened to this podcast, you know, then there are people who do podcasts about our podcast. So I listened to one, and it's three white people talking about the show and having that response. And I was listening to it like at 10:30 at night, like coming home on the train. And I just like, I started just like shaking. And I was like, what are we doing? And what is this? And what is this response? And it just made me, it filled me with just like revulsion. And then I was like, is this my fault? And is this because we're telling, because I put music underneath it? Is this why? Because we're telling stories in an anecdotal way and I put music underneath it and I am structuring it of where you want to know what happens next, but I don't understand any other way to tell this story and I'm trying to tell an emotional story and am I not doing the right work to make the understood of like what is really at stake here, which is like this incredibly complicated relationship that this totally normal guy has with his local police, and to understand that like this isn't an extraordinary story, you know what I mean, that there are thousands if not millions of Jesse Nickersons who are having these same relationships and experiences, and like that's horrifying. And I don't know. Anyway, the next day, Emmanuel and I, and then Sarah, we all had this whole conversation about it. We went down Oh my God, all three of us just went down a cable. It was awful. It was awful. We all felt horrible. We all just were like, oh God. Sarah was dealing with all the juvenile stuff at the time. So she was just doing one interview after another that was like breaking her. And yeah, it was a dark moment. It was a dark moment, but I didn't know where to land.
If I'm hearing you correctly, it's the thing that freaked you out on the train was that you were doing this work that was supposed to shed light on a thing mm-hmm. that people are not familiar with. And instead what they were responding to was kind of like, holy shit moments in the story, because that's what they were used to. Kind of the same way you would respond to like a crazy plot twist in a movie.
Right, right. Exactly.
I think this thing is hard. This question is hard. Like the entertainment versus journalism. Mm-hmm. And my theory is that in part, it's just that it's new. And
right.
Like music is an interesting example of
right.
that. Like people just aren't quite used to music and journalism.
And it's super intimate as well. I think
yeah.
the difference between reading somebody's quotes and hearing somebody talk at length, I think is very, very different.
There's all these moves that get made in magazine stories,
mm-hmm.
which have just come to be accepted because people have been writing stories in that style for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
That I feel like when people hear those moves get made, and I do think it's mostly about recency, it catches their ear in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's other factors too, like ads.
Right.
I feel like changes
but
it.
It's not like you don't have an ad running down the side column of a New Yorker story.
Totally.
Right.
I just think people are used to it.
Right.
But there's also this intimacy thing, which is like you can choose when to have your eye stray over to that ad. But I think the actual thing with Serial, and I wonder if you think this is true, is mostly just that so many people listened.
Yeah.
Like, if so many people hadn't listened, then the critique of this was entertaining wouldn't quite play.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
so that, entertaining that no one listened?
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, like, the criticism is like that it found this huge audience in mm-hmm. this way. Like, it kind of does feel to me like kind of, like, inextricably linked with the result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. I totally agree. And I agree with you about it, the new thing too. And it's something that I actually have always wished. Sometimes I feel like it should be celebrated more. Not to be patting ourselves on our own backs, but like we are making something new in the podcast. These like, definitely I feel like in the long form narrative podcasts, we're making something new. And probably even in the talk show podcast as well. I don't listen to those ones as much. I'm more a long form narrative girl. But I do feel like it's exciting. Like, who's seen a breakthrough in narrative journalism like this, like that we've done with podcasting in the last 5 years? It's really exciting to watch what people are doing. So I feel, and then I feel like, yeah, and then there's going to be ways that you're learning that along the way. That doesn't seem that surprising to me that we might mess up, you know what I mean? Or do something where I wouldn't do it that way, the same way again. Or like, I honestly wouldn't do a season one story again. I wouldn't do something like that. I mean, one is that I didn't quite realize how much people really love a murder story. You know what I mean? I sort of underestimated the appetite for such a thing. probably that kind of thing I maybe wouldn't do again.
One of the incredible stats that we see on long form on the website
uh-huh.
is, I guess it was 2 years ago, we did like the most clicked stories of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And every single one had murder or sex in the title.
Whoa.
Except for the top story,
uh-huh.
which had murder and sex in the title.
I know, I feel like such a dummy being all like, I didn't see this coming.
No, I mean,
right,
it's surprising to me.
Of course.
It's like even like when people are coming for like these like in-depth things to read, it's still just sex and murder.
Which has been that way for eons. Like,
yeah.
We're humans. It's not even an American thing. You know what I mean? It spans all cultures.
All right, I cut you off. So you wouldn't do a murder story again, but...
I mean, maybe we would do a murder story again. Who knows? It depends on, like, what it's about or something. You know what I mean? But I did not appreciate how much it was going to open everybody up, regular, normal civilians, for speculation.
Yeah.
That was the part. Like, for Jay, I understood that it was going to do that. I also felt like, you know, when you have a felony conviction for aiding and in a murder and disposing of a body, like, that's going to happen. So I wasn't as surprised on that one. But then when it started going into a bunch of other people, I was just like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You know, so that I wouldn't. I just know. And I always do that again.
When all that was happening, I mean, I was just paying such close attention, and I was thinking about you guys a lot. And I was always wondering whether, like, your internal narrative was just like, eh, fuck off. But it seems like that was not the case.
Not totally, no.
Got on
top of
you a
little bit.
I mean,
sometimes it's that way. You know, sometimes that's my internal narrative. You mean to, like, criticism or to...
Yeah, and...
I had a little bit of that because there was, like, kind of some of that criticism about S-Town. And for that, I felt like, fuck off. Because I thought it was very, like, sort of Brooklyn Greenpoint kind of criticism of where I was like, you think you're being woke and taking the mantle of sort of, you know, protection or something. But instead, I think you're being condescending, thinking that somebody who lives in a small town in Alabama, that somehow we're taking advantage of them. Mm-hmm. And that I felt more like, fuck off, because that was just ridiculous. That was ridiculous. Everybody understood what they were getting into. Brian had amazing relationships with, he had really amazing relationships with everybody in the show that he still has, that he still maintains, like, profound feelings and connections that people have made with each other. That was where I just felt like, you don't know what the fuck you're talking about, that kind of criticism. So I didn't feel it as much on that stuff.
Yeah. I feel like I should, I could talk to you about this all day, but we should not spend all of our time talking about, some assholes on the internet.
Okay.
We can move on to other
great
assholes.
Thank you.
All right.
Oh, season three, though.
Yeah. Well, here's what I'm interested in, how you do your job.
Okay.
So you guys decide you're going to do this courthouse thing. That idea has been kicking around for you for a while.
It had been kicking around for a while. Sarah had a couple of other ideas. I actually remember where we were when we decided to do it. We were, like, in the Days Inn in Indianapolis. And
what were you doing there?
We had to do a speech in Bloomington, and then we had to spend the night in an airport hotel in Indianapolis.
Just hanging out in Bloomington, as we do.
And so I remember being, they had a, like, one of those circle couches, and so it was very hard not to lay on it. But anyway, we were both sitting on the circle couch. And yeah, there were a couple other ideas, but we had already reached out to Cleveland before season two, because we had kicked around this idea even for season two and knew that had talked to the chief judge at that time and he was open to it. And so that's why I was just like, I still have a fever for the Cleveland story.
Yeah.
If you do, we didn't really have other ideas necessarily.
Yeah,
and
I am interested in, like, what doesn't make the cut? Can you tell me?
I mean, for season two, initially, we were working on a Guantanamo story for season two. And that one, we really wanted to do that one. The idea of that one we thought was, like, a clean conceit would be, like, the final year of the Obama administration and watching as they tried to close Guantanamo. And then, you know, so of course, working on a story like that, like, you spend a ton of time, like, trying to get National Security Council to agree to, like, give us some access. And then, you know, you're talking to various people and they're like, sure, yeah, yeah, let me run it up the flagpole or whatever. And then we're kind of told yes, but then it's one of those things where it becomes clear as you're, like, starting to try and do reporting that, like, their vision of what access is not what our vision of access is. And it turns out, like, they're just basically going to give the exact same interviews that they would give to any other reporter who was reporting on Guantanamo. And then also, you know, it's national security and stuff is classified. And so it was just getting harder and harder to figure out a way to do it where you could get people on the record. I think even the print reporters, you know, and there were like Carol Rosenberg at My Herald and Charlie Savage at the New York Times, like, those guys do incredible Guantanamo reporting. It just became clear. I was like, there's nothing we do here that adds to their stuff. Like, I wouldn't want to do this unless it felt like we were adding to what they do. Instead, we'd just be doing a cheap version. So we killed that. But we still had it in the back of our mind someday of, like, being like, somebody should do this, though. If everyone could agree to, like, we're not going to worry about classifying. We're not going to worry about saying things on the record. This is an amazing story. It's an amazing story. But anyway, so like those kinds of things, like we spend time looking into stuff and then have to kill them. And then for season three, I can't though honestly think of what was a different, I don't think we even had anything that felt that real.
Mm-hmm. So you're sitting on the circular couch in Indianapolis.
And I was like, I'm still into this one. And we had done a little bit of work at that point. Sarah had like done, I think she had gone back out. She had gone to Cleveland. She had watched a trial just to get in there and just like get her head around it and meet people and stuff like that, just to see. And so it was at that point where I was just like, I'm still into this. I still feel like it's going to be a bitch to structure. This is going to be a real bitch to structure. And I don't have an idea necessarily of how we're going to do that. But I think like it's worth trying. Oh, one of the things we had talked about doing, although that was kind of a Cleveland thing too, we discussed possibly trying to do like a more in-depth story about the death of Tamir Rice. Because some of the transcripts that were released on the internal investigation on that were really telling and interesting.
Why didn't you do that?
I think we thought it was going to be pretty hard to get the people on the police side to do on-the-record interviews. And it felt like if they weren't going to talk, we were going to be a little stymied. Because you wanted to have, like, real, genuine conversations. And they were still under litigation, and they're, yeah.
All right. So you guys decide, Indianapolis, circular couch, mm-hmm. this is what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And then what part of this does Sarah do and what part do you do?
So then at that point, like I basically more help with the logistics of it, of where I was like, well, obviously you can't move to Cleveland. I mean, the way we, Cleveland, the reason we did Cleveland is both because Ohio has very good recording laws, like, and Sarah lives in the middle of Pennsylvania. She lives in State College, Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania has terrible, like they don't even let you, like, I don't even know if you can take notes in the courtroom. So Cleveland, it was both Ohio's got good transparency laws, but also it's 4 hours from State College. So yeah, it didn't seem that taxing for her to be able to go to Cleveland fairly often. But I did know that I was like, somebody's got to live there, though. We need somebody who's there every day. And at that point, like I talked to Dana about it, who had worked on season one, but she didn't want to she didn't want to move to Cleveland. But also she went over to This American Life and she was like, I feel like I got some stories here that I want to report. And so that was really fine. And so then at that point, Emmanuel was just finishing his fellowship at This American Life. And I really liked Emmanuel and I really liked working with him. And he was also pretty young. And so like the idea, and then it was, you know, he's from Ohio. He went to Ohio State. All his family is still, a bunch of his family is still in Toledo. He knew Cleveland pretty well. And for him, he was totally fine with moving to Cleveland. He always makes jokes about, he really genuinely, he's like a Cleveland defender or booster, kind of. Mm-hmm. Like which was good because Sarah and I would be like much more derisive sometimes. But
pretty good career opportunity.
Yeah, I guess it was a good career opportunity. So yeah, so that's like kind of more what I started doing just at the beginning, is just handling the logistics of that and like, okay, let's move Emmanuel to Cleveland and setting up Sarah and Emmanuel live together, which was so bizarre. But I normally would never have agreed to that, but they both were agreeing to it. So I was like, okay. Emmanuel's 25. Sarah's like 48. I was like, that's what you want to do? You want to share an apartment with your 48-year-old boss? It was so weird. But Sarah's kind of got a thing. She doesn't like hotels. And anyway.
Did they get along all right?
They got along fine. They got along fine. I always thought it was really funny, though, after one of like the first times that Sarah went after they had moved into the apartment, she was baffled because they had like spent the day together reporting. I think they had gone out for dinner that night with a source, like with an attorney. And Sarah was like, it was like a real dinner. Like we ate and everything. And then I think they even had drinks afterwards or something. And she said that they got back to the apartment like at 10 or 10:30. It was a long night. And Emmanuel started making a chicken breast. And she was just like, what the fuck? We just ate. Like who starts making themselves a chicken breast at 10:30 at night. And I loved it. I was like, you live with a 24-year-old boy. I was like, I think they do. And I was like, second dinner. That's it. You just gotta, yeah. But anyway, so I kind of just, and so at that point, for the first couple of months, a lot of what I am doing is fielding phone calls from them, where they're telling me about the people that they're meeting and the stories and cases and observations. If I can, if I'm not too busy, I like logging the tape. Yeah, I like logging the tape. I won't log all, you know, I can't log all of it, but I like to do like kind of sample parts so that like later when I read the transcripts, like I can have them in my head and I know that kind of stuff.
Do you have a pretty good memory for that stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. And so then usually what I do is like, I'm kind of talking back the stories to them. I think they kind of give me all the details and then I give them sort of a pitch for the story. So it's kind of like if I had to summarize their story, this is the way that I would summarize it. And I think that helps them to get a clarity of like what to go for next, you know, in terms of reporting. I think that's usually their question is like, what else do I need or what more should I do or what's the other elements and stuff? And so having me talk it back, then we can see what we're missing.
And if the hole on that one, when you decided to go for it, was structure, when does that start coming into place?
Not until we've finished pretty much all the reporting. So that was like after probably 10 months of reporting. Like I felt like at that point I knew that we had like 8 or 9 separate stories or cases that I was pretty interested in, and then a couple other topics, you know. And so at that point, me and Sarah and Emmanuel, we went to State College because we were always making Sarah come to New York, so we agreed to go to State College for a couple of days. And that's when we just start the beginning process of breaking everything down and looking at orders and thinking about like what could connect all this stuff. And that's when you kind of start having like kind of crazy ideas and think like, maybe we do this like really, I don't know, experimental structural thing that would, you know what I mean? And we just have to go through that process a lot. So we probably structured it over the course of, it probably took us about 2 months to structure it because we did that and then like would put more stuff together, and then we presented it all to Ben Calhoun, who's a producer on Serial, and we presented it all to Ben and got like feedback from Ben, and then like kind of changed it again.
You're presenting like drafts of episodes?
No, we're just talking like an outline. Yeah, just talking them through the stories.
And how do you and Sarah work in those 2 months? Like, is it like one idea from you, one idea from her? Are you like driving it? How do you guys work together?
Structurally, usually I'm driving it because that's like kind of what she relies on me to do, is the structure part. So in those 2 months, I think I'm thinking about it more and I'm staring at it and then I'm playing around with it.
And you doing that all like in your, like just like in your head?
This time we got, which I just realized I am still paying for, we got like an online whiteboard thing where you could put like note cards on it and it all looks like a whiteboard, but you know, it exists on a website.
Yeah.
So we could all be on it since Sarah's remote. But yeah, it took me forever to find the right like program that would allow me to do that. I remember I spent a lot of time trying to find a computer software program that would let me do that. Yeah, and I just got the bill for it where I realized I'm still paying $400 a year for it, where I was like, oops, I don't need that anymore. But yeah, that's what I was mainly doing and moving stuff around. And then once we were like kind of like, okay, let's try this, then she wrote a first draft. But she started writing a first draft of the first episode and then was like, I think actually we should go back to this other structure and this other story should be the first episode, which was one we had decided to kill in the structure. And I was like, okay, if that's what you think. And so then we wasted like 6 weeks on that one and ultimately ended up killing it anyway, because it had all the same problems to it that we had identified initially. But
do you like withhold the I told you so in that situation?
No. I mean, I don't say I have a lot of insane ideas that like don't work either. That'd be really bad if I. Yeah.
All right, so when you
get a first draft of the first episode, mm-hmm. who do you play that for?
Me.
What do you mean?
Well, so Sarah and I always do, when she gets the first draft, she plays it, just the two of us do it. And then basically what we usually, it depends on how much time we have, but basically it's just like the two of us try and get it kind of to a point where it at least resembles the thing we're trying to say. Uh-huh. You know, kind of takes us a little while sometimes. So we fix all the things that are obvious and try and tighten it in a way that it is more in line with the thing we were trying to say. And then at that point, we take it to an edit with, always with Ira. And then there are certain This American Life producers that are really helpful to us, but you kind of have to work off their schedule. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like whoever's available. But we did, especially for the first episode, the first episodes are so hard, you know, and you go through so many drafts. So I think Nancy Updike, Brian Reed, Hannah Jaffe Wall, all of those guys came in on edits.
Well, that's the question I have sort of, is that first draft that you play for people, how close is that to what I heard?
It's the same. Oh, the very first draft, actually, you know, initially our idea was that we were going to, yeah, see what I mean? Crazy structures. We were going to like tell parts of stories and then let them off like at certain moments and pick up another story. Mm-hmm. And this is so stupid because it sounds so obviously like it wouldn't work. There was a theory behind it, which is when you're in the courthouse, it's not like things get resolved that day, right? So you're kind of constantly, the actual experience of being in the courthouse is sort of always being like sort of at the beginning and middle of a bunch of stories. And so we were trying to see if we could model and mimic that, but it ended up.
I feel like people should know that, like, you cannot keep a straight face while you're talking
so
about
it. Stupid. It was so stupid. I mean, of course it wouldn't have worked. So, but that is a draft that we had played of where we do not resolve that first bar fight story. Uh-huh. And I think the problem with it then was everyone was just like, I don't even have any idea why you're telling me this story then, because it's really small. And then when I would explain why we were doing it, and I was just like, I can't believe this is the one they point to as working. And this is so many of the cases where everyone in the end is like, great. And I just was like, the price that this woman paid is rough. And it's not acknowledged. And everyone kind of pointed out like, oh, I like that. But you'd have to get to the end of her story in order to point all of that out. Mm-hmm. And we were like, oh, all right. So yeah, it was kind of like some of those first drafts are pretty different. Like, we didn't tell the full story.
And is that, you've only done three seasons and one season of S-Town, mm-hmm. but you've been making stories in audio for a really long time. Is that just what it takes? Is there no way to do it faster? Is that just like how it's going
to
go?
I think there's totally a way to do it faster. I don't think it'll be as emotional or intimate or layered. So, because I feel like I've heard other shows that do it faster and kind of like a little bit, just a different style. There's just like a way different style. And I think that works too. That's just like, it doesn't, you don't feel that emotional in those stories, and you don't feel like necessarily like super connected to them. You don't feel like completely immersed in the way that you can with like a novel or a movie or a TV show where you sort of feel surrounded by the characters. So for us, I feel like if we're trying to go for the kind of immersion experience, I don't know any other way except for stumbling around until we get to it. But I do think that there's a faster way to do it where it maybe has other strengths. And I would like to definitely, we've talked about trying to explore that.
Yeah.
Because it's, I used to feel so bad for documentary filmmakers where I was like, oh my God, you must be so bored. And the idea of, I mean, I still kind of feel that way. The idea of spending like 7 years on the same story to then play it at a film festival. I was just like, oh my God, that sounds awful. But I do feel a little like I'm in that position now where it's like 2 years on the same story. It's a little bit of a grind. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we've actually been talking about, is there a different, we've talked about, is there a different model for doing it? But I think ultimately the form kind of follows the function. So we'd have to find the story first and then think like, is there a faster way to do this kind of story?
That's interesting. The thing I was kind of asking about, yeah, was more like,
despite lots of experience, is stumbling a guarantee?
Oh, for me it is.
Like, yes.
For me it is.
The process is not like you do this enough times and then suddenly you can see it immediately.
Well, I would think, like, of course, well, like, that can happen because I worked at This American Life for 18 years, and that definitely happened. You know, I became a lot faster and at telling stories and just, like, a lot easier. And there are certain things that you know, and you just get to it all a lot faster.
Do you have, like, rules?
Mm-hmm.
What are the rules?
I mean, there's all the, like, what are you listening for? Like, what's at stake and what are you listening for? And why are you telling me this? And, like, that kind of always has to be, like, you have to be able to answer kind of that at every single moment of the story. You have to always know when you're listening to a story the answer to those three questions. And I think that's what we're doing in the edits because, you know, you have whole sections where you're just like, I liked it. I didn't know why we were listening to it, you know? And so then you're just like, fuck.
I mean, are those the same questions in a series? It's just kind of like harder to answer them when you're doing something that's 6 hours long or 10 hours long?
No, because they're always something you should be able to answer in the moment, you know? Like, so I feel like it's harder with the structure of season three. Here's the thing. Who committed this murder? That has got to be part of the reason people do so many of those stories is because it's the easiest structure of all time. Like, I did not appreciate what a clarifying question that is that has stakes and drives. Like, you don't have to restate it. You don't have, like, it keeps the tension for so long. We were trying to think of, is there an easier question than who committed the murder? And I'm not sure if there is. It's the easiest one. It's really easy. It might be why, you know, a lot of people do those stories now.
Yeah.
So I missed that.
I mean, the easier, only easier one might be like, who fucked who?
Yeah. Then you get sex and murder. But with season three especially, it was hard because it felt like we were sort of like gearing up the machinery of every episode every time. But then hitting a point after like the fourth episode of being like, wait, why are you doing this at all?
Yeah.
So we do have a reset at the beginning of episode six.
Okay, so that one's done. Season three is done. Now are you like casting about for season four? What do you do now? Like, what'd you do today?
Well, now I'm working on it's going to be a smaller project about public education. And I'm doing that with Hannah Jaffe Walt, who's a producer at This American Life. And she's covered education. She's an intended education reporting at This American Life. And so this is a project that it's really funny, but we've been working on it on and off for like 3 years. So finally we will do that one.
And that'll be like a standalone thing or a This American Life standalone?
Be a standalone thing because it's like five episodes. It's kind of long, but it's not like as long as a serial, but longer than a This American Life thing. But I think we might put that one down the serial feed just because it's not huge, you know, right? What I mean? I don't know. Anyway, we don't have to talk about business, but this is a business question, but we might do it that way. But anyway, so I'm working on that with Hannah. And then at the same time, Sarah is looking into two stories that she's been interested in for a while. But also, we're a little killing time because we're waiting for Dana to be finished with a story she's doing for This American Life so that she can come back because Sarah and Dana have an idea that they want to do for like a TV show. So they're going to take like, I don't know, like 6 months to try and see if they can figure out a way to get that thing to work.
Will you work on that?
Yeah, then I'll work on that too.
You into the TV stuff?
I like this one. I like this one a lot. I normally have not, you know, we option a lot of the stories, like they get optioned for TV and film, like after we do them, and This American Life stories do all the time and stuff too. And I've always had a hard time sticking with that. I'm so done with thinking about that story. Like, I don't have any other thoughts about that story. Like, we did it. I don't have anything more to say. So it's really hard for me, like those options, because I'm just like, sure, but you know, kind of to the producer or the director or the screenwriter, that I'm like, you're going to have to kind of drive this train, because I don't have a lot of ideas. But this one is not an adaptation of a story. So this one, which I can't talk about what it's about, but because those guys probably don't even totally really know what it's about, or we have three different ideas of what it's about, I think. But this one I'm really excited about. I'm excited to try it. So that would be setting aside 6 months, which is a little hard because that's 6 months that we're not making season four of Serial.
That doesn't worry you?
I mean, I've got Hannah's thing, and then I'm also talking with Nancy Updike about a story that she's looking into, and I was like, maybe that. And that one, if she does it, that is a big story. So I was like, maybe that's season four of Serial. We've always talked about maybe Serial doesn't have to always be Sarah. It kind of depends on like what they find in the next couple of months, you know? And I'm also always open to like stories might just come up, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They just come up. So probably something will come up as well. Like, and we'll have to make some choices.
At this point with like the success that you guys have had with Serial and S-Town, do you feel like people will just stick with you?
Not necessarily, but I do think we have more, you know, because the brand basically, like, it's still a strong name, you know what I mean? I think, like, and there are still, like, a lot of people who have only ever listened to one podcast, and that was the first season of Serial. Those are people who also don't know that we have second and third seasons of Serial. Like, Serial to them is just the Adnan Syed story, and there's never been anything else. And I get that, you know what I mean? But I do think, like, yeah, like, we're kind of known for making pretty good stuff. So, yeah. So in that way, I don't worry about it that much, you know? Like, I feel like we've got it, like, it's nice to have this American life as well of being, like, run anything. We didn't run anything from S-Town or season two or three. We ran the first episode of Serial on This American Life. I do actually think maybe the first episode of Hannah's thing would be actually a really good This American Life episode. So we might do that. So that always helps, you know what I mean, to get the word out as well. This American Life has always been really great for other podcasts too. People take their stories, and I think everyone always says it really helps their numbers.
What's your relationship with This American Life now?
I mean, we're all still together, you know what I mean? We're all on the 11th floor and there's a lot of movement back and forth. Everyone we have a thing like Serial and This American Life are two separate companies, but there is a holding company that provides like services. So that's like how we do it, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I am the CEO of Serial. Ira is the CEO of This American Life. We do make choices together, you know what I mean, for overhead stuff and everything. And we share a CFO and we share a COO and all that kind of stuff. But then also, like, the staff is moving back and forth all the time. Sarah's been doing a lot of edits for This American Life because now Brian's taking off and he's going to do another project. So it's kind of like there's a lot of flowing back and forth.
For you, was there ever any, like, thought of spinning this stuff out on its own?
What do you mean?
Like, you worked with Alex Blumberg for years and he went and started his own podcast company. Like, you started a podcast company within another company.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder whether there's had ever been this idea that like those could live further outside that umbrella.
I think they could. I mean, Serial is technically, if we wanted to, like, Ira can own Serial or WBZ, honestly. I mean, like, when we started Serial, it was just on the surplus budget of This American Life. We were all employees at that time of WBEZ. I owned half of This American Life. BEZ owned half of This American Life. They then separated. And then technically, you know, Ira then owned Serial. And incredibly graciously, like, he turned around and gave it to me and Sarah. And we spun it off as its own company. And then so it's owned by me and Sarah and Ira.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're, like, sort of a separate company, but, like, you know what I mean?
Only sort of.
I mean, nothing has really totally changed, you know what I mean? So, yeah, like, going off and starting a whole new company, I don't have the entrepreneurial spirit that way. And I don't think I have the confidence of doing that either. But I'm a lot more into the stories, you know what I mean?
You don't have the confidence on, like, the business side?
Yeah, kind of. And I don't have any interest either. When it comes to business stuff, and I do all the business stuff, but I feel like the business stuff is always in service of the stories. Mm-hmm. So I kind of need to know what is the story or what is the show that we're building an infrastructure around. And then I'm fine with doing the business stuff. But to build an infrastructure for the sake of then creating other stuff, I lose steam kind of quickly. And I'm just like, why don't we just build it when we need it? Uh-huh. So that works better for me.
I feel like you should write like a business book. That's like a different, that's a different approach to being the CEO. Yeah.
I think it's probably been proven in the business world to be a bad, path.
I feel like it's working out all right.
It's working out okay right now. Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping we can talk a little bit about the 18 years at This American Life.
Oh yeah.
I have questions about the early days, and I'm interested in that. But I went back and listened to a bunch of the stories that you.
Oh my God! Really?
Yeah. And I listened to the first one. Actually, you sound very different.
What is it?
It's about like Fight Night.
Oh my gosh. Oh wow.
Do you remember that one?
I do remember Fight Night. Oh, is it like a Lucha Libre thing?
Yeah,
but what's it about? Is that actually the problem with the story?
I mean, no. It's like...
I don't even remember what it was about. What year was it?
It's episode 93.
Okay.
I don't know what year that is.
Okay, that would be probably 98.
How old are you then?
I would have been in 98. I would have been 26, 25. I started in 97. I started in March of 97.
You legitimately sound different. Like, you a little bit sound like a different person.
Smoking. It's terrible.
I don't know. You kind of sound like more of a smoker than, to be honest.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. It's very like
could be the mics.
It's great, and you're very deadpan.
Oh my God.
Pretty deadpan.
Yeah. Probably I was just terrified. I really hate doing stories. I hate reporting. I hate doing stories. It is the world's... that is why I don't do stories.
Here's the whole thing I want to ask you about. This
yeah.
is the whole reason that you're here.
Mm-hmm.
Is this is the thing I need to understand. Is how can you be this person? I'm going to embarrass you for a second. Like in this audio world,
mm-hmm.
you are like a deity. People call you a genius. This is a thing that is true. All the time about these stories, and you're sitting there and helping these world-class, incredible reporters think through their things, but you don't want to do it.
No.
Why?
I find it's so uncomfortable for me.
Why?
I'm not good at it. I'm not both. I don't love talking to people I don't already know. And so I'm very self-conscious. And then I'm not a good writer. I feel like I've now finally, 20 years in, have become a functional writer. So I can write for somebody else in a very functional way. But luckily now I'm in a position of where I rarely ever have to do that because I'm working with such good writers. But mainly, like, I really hated, like, being edited. I felt so uncomfortable and exposed and vulnerable. And I realized I did a story one time of where I was so miserable and uncomfortable in the edits. I just wanted to get it over with. And, you know, obviously always your editor will suggest things sometimes. And it's up to the reporter to protect the story and say, I don't think that's fair, or that's not what I want to do, or that's not true, or something. And I recognized in myself that I would completely sell these people out to have this whole thing be over with. And that felt really dangerous. Like, I was like, you shouldn't even have me near a microphone then, because I'm untrustworthy. I'm so uncomfortable that you shouldn't trust me because I just want this over with. So that's, and I don't need to do it. I don't feel a desire to do it. Sometimes it's a little frustrating because I always have ideas. And so it's a little frustrating if I can't get other people to sign on to my, you know, because I'm constantly lobbying people to do the stories that I think that they should do. And I can get frustrated too if I'm just like, no, not like that, you know? So that can be a little bit frustrating, but I also know they're so much better at it than I am, and I wouldn't want to do it, and I would just mess it up anyway and stuff like that. So sometimes it can get a little frustrating, but you know, I have enough people who do my ideas. I mean, we just did season 3 with all of my ideas. Like, it was fine. You know what I mean? Like, I have people, like, they'll do stories that I want them to do.
Do you like being behind the scenes, or do you just not want to do the reporting stuff? Or both, I guess.
I don't feel that. It's not that behind the scenes, just because it's not like radio reporters are that visible. You know what I mean? So it doesn't feel like there's a huge difference between me and the reporters. Except for Serial. Yes.
The genre-defining thing that you made, which became about a person.
I totally recognize in that way that Sarah really took the hits on that one. And I was like, oh my God, thank God it's not me. But
it's kind of amazing that like attention and being the person who's like getting critiqued is so uncomfortable to you, and then you were the other half of that thing.
I know.
That got the most attention ever.
I know. Well, Sarah doesn't like it either. She's even more thin-skinned than I am.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Luckily, Sarah does not know how to use social media. So so I'm just like, that's good. You can't respond to people. You can't. Otherwise, she could be like a troll. I don't know. She would. Yeah, anyway. No, and she holds back too. She doesn't respond to emails sometimes, occasionally, but I like it when she does. Ira Glass does that occasionally too. We'll respond to like a totally random critical email, and you don't know why it's this one that he chose that just got under his skin, but he's so good at it. It's so good. Oh my God. He's so good, and they feel great, like reading the response to them, and then always everybody capitulates right away.
Are they like empathetic or
no? He really breaks them down. No, in a cheerful way, he will completely break them down as to why, in every way, that they're wrong and that it's like kind of like unfair and annoying the thing that they're saying. It's really fun. He doesn't do it that often. I would say he does it like 3 times a year, but he'll either forward it to us or sometimes CC us. Mm-hmm. He did one, I remember, after the first season of Serial, there was a review of the final episode in the New York Times, which was crazy that we were getting reviewed. And like, reviewed? What? And it was really positive, too. I have to say, it was a very, very positive review that, of course, is going to have, like, you know, one part that, like, is like, you know, a little critical and stuff. And I love that Ira took issue with it. And did he call the Times report? No, I think he wrote him. And it was ridiculous that he was defending us that way. Like, we were just like, this is so silly. You totally don't have to do this. But it felt really good. It felt like somebody was in your corner. Mm-hmm. It felt like he loved us. I've tried to keep it in mind of doing it for other people sometimes too. And so sometimes I will do it. Engage a listener or something like that to defend Sarah on her behalf or something like that, just because I care. Anyway, I'm so sorry. I forgot how I went down this path. Oh, yeah, we're thin-skinned, whatever. Anyway, yeah.
So, sorry.
I don't like reporting.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. I mean, did you, when you decided, like, I'm not going to do this anymore, did you feel great relief? Do you have any regrets about that?
No. No, I felt a total relief. And no, I don't have regrets about it. I mean, it was also coupled with, at the time, you know, when I started on This American Life, at that point, This American Life was like, I think, had been a national show for about 6 months. I think they'd been together for about a year or something. And so it was 3 producers. It was me, Nancy Updike, Elise Spiegel, and then Ira was the host. And we couldn't do reruns because we didn't have a catalog to do reruns. And so we were kind of just like killing ourselves, working all the time. Also, just the technology, we didn't know what we were doing, and we didn't have the technology that we have now. So just everything took a long time. Everything took longer to do. And so there were like real system problems in what we were doing. Like, I remember one of the main ones is that we would come up with themes for shows. You know, we would assign, each of us would have like 3 shows coming up, you know, that we were in charge of. And then each of us would just start to work the phones because we email wasn't even that popular then. So you start working the phones and just calling all the contributors being all like, do you got anything on, you know what I mean? That didn't turn out the way I thought it was. Do you got anything on like bad idea? You know what I mean? And then they very thoughtfully and kindly would genuinely consider it and then call you back with a pitch. But by the time they called you back, it was like 3 days later. And at that point, you would be buried in your next story that you were doing. So you didn't have time to deal with them. And I remember after like 2 or 3 years of doing that, I think it was Jack Hitt who told me, it's not a very nice way to treat us. Like, we actually put thought into this. We care. We give you a pitch and then you just
never respond.
Yeah, you ghost me and then you call me 2.5 months later as if this never happened and you just ask me about a bunch of other themes and do I have anything for that? And it's kind of getting on my nerves. And I thought that was a really, really fair criticism. And I was like, I hear you. See how that would be irritating. So at that point, like, it was kind of like, you guys, we need a better system. We need to like organize this better of where certain people do certain things and stuff. And so it was like, just in those ways, naturally, I was like, I'll run the theme list. Why don't I be the person who is the consistent person? So I'm going to do less like reported stories so that I'm more available for the contributors so that we're not ghosting them like this. You know what I mean? So yeah. It was like, it just started becoming more clear that like, we really actually need somebody in a position. And it's very helpful that I don't want to report stories and that I don't leave for like 3 months while I was go that, and do it.
Was that like a known quantity? Did everyone know that you didn't like doing it?
Yeah. Because Iroh always would encourage me to do it. And I was just like, I don't want to do it. And he was always incredibly, supportive. And he was just like, you don't like that you're bad at it. But the only way to get better at it is just to keep doing it. And, you know, you're a good talker. You just have to learn how to write like you talk. And I couldn't even imagine that. I was like, oh, my God, I have like no vocabulary. All I do is say like all the time. I'm not a good talker.
Do you think he was right, though?
That I would have gotten better? Of course. I've gotten better at the job. I'm sure I would have gotten. I've already noticed that I'm better at doing it and stuff. But I do really think for these stories and to pull off both what they're doing at This American Life and what I'm kind of doing now, I do think you need somebody who isn't going to disappear on their own stories for months at a time. And actually, that's a struggle that This American Life is dealing with right now, because now almost all the producers at This American Life are also reporters, which was sort of a shift that the show made like 7 or 8 years ago, of where more of the stories now are actually produced kind of in-house. But now it's kind of a problem because who's running this thing, you know?
Everyone wants to just go make their stuff.
Yeah, kind of.
Well, I think that's part of why I'm asking is like, that's been my experience in this audio world too, is like, everyone just kind of wants to make their stuff.
I know. It's really hard.
Except for you.
I don't. Yeah. I really don't. I'm trying to encourage more people. I have totally tried to encourage more people to take my job. I'm just like, you get to be very bossy. You get to be kind of a dilettante. I don't work on the things I don't want to do. If I'm working with a contributor and they're like, or a producer, and it's right at the point where it looks like things are going to get kind of hard and hairy, like, I can leave. Like, it's nice.
I read this commencement speech that Ira gave at Columbia.
Yeah, I just read it. I saw it was going around on the internet.
I feel like it's like a real like ode to you.
It's really nice. I wondered if, the Columbia graduates were just like, who the hell is she?
Here, you can read the end.
You want me to read it out loud?
I want you to read it out loud.
Okay. Choose your jobs with a careful eye on who your editor will be. Good news is very few editors, in my experience, are awful. The overwhelming majority are solid, decent, helpful. And then if you're lucky, you get somebody like the people I work with, like Julie Snyder, people who make everything they touch so much better. That is so nice. That is so nice.
It's pretty nice.
Yeah, it's really nice. I know. No, that is that. I was really, really touched. I was really, really touched about that. We have a really nice relationship. It's like a little hard to even talk about, like, we've known each other for so long. And like, because now Ira and I have been together for 20 years, a little longer. And like, you know, we've been through a lot together. Like, we've had huge fights, and we've had resentments, and then we've had, you know, like, we've shared so much of our, like, greatest moments, you know what I mean? And I admire him so much. And the things that he's taught me that I didn't realize he was teaching me in the moment that I've learned later, even still have it now, like, kind of now, I'm taking a little less from it editorially and a little more now from it, like, as a person and business-wise. He's incredibly gracious and giving, and it's not a problem for him to do, and it takes nothing from him, and he wants to do it. And I'm like, yeah, I want to be like that. I want to be like him. But yeah, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. And like, I know his, you know, his parents and like his sisters and, you know what I mean? He knows my parents and like, of course. And then, you know, there's a picture of him dancing with my grandma at my wedding. And like, you know, he knows my husband pretty well. And I don't know, just like all that kind of stuff. Like, we've just been around each other for a really long time.
Yeah. I actually don't know what that's like.
It's emotional. It's kind of emotional. Like, it's different, you know, like my relationship with Sarah now is, because we're both women and we're like the same age, that one is much more like kind of, I think, what you would expect. Like, we're really up each other's asses. Like, you know what I mean? And we definitely turn to each other to talk about, I'm having a problem with the kids. Like, wait, can I ask you about this one thing? You know, like, I went to the doctor the other day and I had this, you know what I mean? Like, we have those kinds of conversations. We're very, very close. And it's more emotional. Whereas like Ira and I wouldn't do that kind of stuff together. You know, you're still like my boss and there's a difference of that. But like the thing that he built that is so incredible that he built, like, I watched him do it, you know, and like was kind of next to him while he did it. And it's really sweet. It's really, really, really sweet for him. This commencement speech thing means so much to me because I don't know my worth, I think. Or I didn't, or whatever. I just didn't, never really knew if, it's hard when you're not doing the stories sometimes, because there is a little bit of a culture at This American Life of where you're as good as your last story. And so if you're not doing stories, sometimes that would be hard, where you wouldn't know exactly where you stand and how important are you and do you even matter and that kind of stuff. And there was always kind of a culture, I think, because everybody started there so young, that there was a lot of emotion and ego and everything built into it. Like, work was everything, you know, and that defined your self-worth. And so I had a hard time with a lot of that stuff, you know. It really only kind of got better, like, when I had kids, which is something weird. Like, honestly, part of the reason I wanted to have a kid is because I knew, I was like, I need something that feels like it's more important than this job. And it worked. It helps. And I think a lot of other people that I've now talked to there have said the same thing, that like, it helps. But anyway, I haven't always known if I'm that important. And so it's really sweet for Ira to say this stuff. I really appreciate it. You know, I really appreciate, it's really kind, because that's how I feel about him.
You didn't know that because that was like the culture of the place?
My worth?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not doing stories. You know what I mean? So sometimes that is hard, because you're just like, I don't know if I'm that important. I don't know if the decisions that I'm making are that important. There wasn't like totally a way to hear the words good job, you know? And it wasn't like the kind of place where you got like reviews or anything like that. You know what I mean? We were supposed to do reviews, and we never did them. The only time when we started doing them was because finally WBZ wrote me into doing the review. So I started doing reviews of the other producers. But I don't know if Ira ever gave me a review. But like, yeah, so you don't get a lot of opportunities, you know what I mean, to hear that stuff.
In the Julie Snyder, like, self-worth timeline, mm-hmm. Where does Serial fit? Like, had you sorted that stuff out by then?
It really helped. It helped. It made me feel like, look at this. We made this thing by ourselves. Like, and it was big, and we can do this. That really helped. It helped, I think, in the self-worth thing. I think I felt proud of it and confident that we could do this. Like, I felt that way at This American Life, too. Like, we had taken on a lot of, like, the biggest project I had done before Serial, like 2 years before, was we had done, and now it seems smaller, but at the time it felt like big, was this two-part This American Life thing about Harper High School on the South Side of Chicago. And so that was, but see, that's one of those things where it's my idea and then I go out and I get other people to do it who can do it so much better than me. They make it so much better. Initially, my idea was a little different. I wanted to do all the shootings over Memorial Day weekend, and we would report out each shooting. But then that started becoming very clear that that was going to be like a logistical problem, because it's like kind of hard to be like a reporter from New York and you show up someone's door and then you're just like, why? Who shot that dude? And why? Although people are much more willing to talk about it as long as you're not in a courtroom than you would think. But then that one kind of morphed into setting it inside Harper. But it was sort of a similar idea. But like that made me feel good, like doing that show. Like I was like, that was a big project. I had an idea. I gathered the reporters. I gathered the people together like that I thought could do it. I managed them over the course of the 6 months that they were reporting. And then we put together this whole big project. And that felt like we really pretty much, I mean, Ira came in as an editor on it, but it was really like kind of like I did it on my own. And so that gave me confidence too, that I was like, I can do these things.
How long was that after you started the show?
Oh, Harper?
Yeah.
Oh, that was like right before Serial. I think we did it in like 2013 or something like that. I mean, we had done other stuff too.
I know. But... it's kind of wild to hear, you know?
I know. Yeah.
Okay, I only have one more question.
Okay.
And you can go. What are you going to do with the rest of your life?
Oh.
Like here you are. You've been working at this place for however many years.
Mm-hmm.
It's had all these iterations and different chapters and lives, and then you like started this whole next one. Like, do you just do this forever? Is that how this works?
I think so. I mean, I would like to get to a point where I would really like to develop somebody who does what I do. I'm having a hard time finding somebody who doesn't want to report stories. So that's like kind of my idea right now, is like, I got to try and see if I can find somebody who wants to do what I do, and then see if I can bring them along and do that so that we could be in a position of where we could be creating more stuff. That's like kind of we have a sort of pipeline problem right now. Yeah. But if I could be in a position someday of where we're facilitating people making cool stuff and I don't have to worry about money that much, yeah, I'm totally happy with to keep on keeping on.
How do you find that person?
I don't know. I realize that every podcast company is asking themselves that question.
Yeah, maybe it's not that easy.
Everyone wants to do their own thing. They don't want to make their own shows. I know. I got to find a sort of unambitious.
Well, do you think it's clearly...
bad writer.
Clearly you're not unambitious, right?
Right.
So what is that thing, though? Can you, like, are you able to put your finger on it? Like, what is this, like, genetic radio mutation you have that makes you not want to do this when everyone else who does this wants to be on the mic?
I don't know how to even define it. Seems so natural and normal to me. I don't see that hosting your own show seems so great. So I'm not sure why so many people want to do it.
Well, thanks for coming on this one.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor, who always does a great job but put in a lot of extra work this week on a really long episode, is Janelle Pfeiffer. Thank you, Janelle. Our intern is Tyler McCloskey. Our sponsors are MailChimp and Pit Writers. Thanks to them for making this thing possible. And thanks so much to Julie Snyder for coming in and taking all that time. It was a
genuine thrill, truly. We'll see you next week. Don't forget, live long-form podcast party show taping. Taffy brought us her Ackner, Evan Ratliff, new book, The Mastermind. It's all going to happen February 13th at the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York. Go get your tickets. They are totally free. Come hang out. We'd love to see you.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.